in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. Three more nations have joined an international investigation team probing war crimes in Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Charles Deledesma has details.
Estonia, Latvia and Slovakia have signed an agreement during a two-day coordination meeting in The Hague to join Lithuania, Poland and Ukraine in the joint investigation team that will help coordinate the sharing of evidence of atrocities through the EU Judicial Cooperation Agency Eurojust. As well, International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan says he plans to open an office in Kiev amid ongoing calls for those responsible for atrocities since Russia's invasion to be brought to justice. I'm Charles Deledesma.
French and Ukrainian officials Tuesday are strongly condemning the killing of French journalist Frédéric Leclerc-Imoff, shot while riding in a bus evacuating civilians from the war zone near Severodonetsk. From his Twitter account, French President Emmanuel Macron said he shares the pain of the family, relatives, and colleagues of Leclerc-Imoff, and to them he sent his condolences, adding, to those who carry out the difficult mission of informing in theaters of operations, he reiterated France's unconditional support. In a statement, Ukrainian officials said, "We strongly condemn this killing. The list of Russian crimes against media workers in Ukraine keeps on expanding." Meanwhile, officials in eastern Ukraine say Russia has taken over half of the crucial town of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. The shelling there, the report has been going on 24/7 for the past several days. This is VOA News. The United Nations humanitarian agencies warned Tuesday millions of people face severe hunger in the eastern Horn of Africa as the worst drought in more than 40 years could extend to a fifth consecutive failed rainy season. In a joint statement, the agency said the March-May rainy season appears likely to be the driest on record, devastating livelihoods and deepening a humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia, Somalia, and parts of Kenya, including a risk of famine in Somalia. There is a risk that the October-December rainy season could also fail. Drought has combined with global rise in food and fuel prices pushed by war in Ukraine to impact millions of people across the continent. An estimated 16.7 million people currently face acute food insecurity in East Africa, and that figure could increase to 20 million by September. The World Meteorologist Organization, in a statement, said the threat of starvation looms in East Africa. This is after four failed rainy seasons. A U.S. jury has acquitted a Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign lawyer on charges of lying to the FBI. The Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has details.
Estonia, Latvia, and...
The case against Michael Sussman was the first courtroom test of special counsel John Durham, who was appointed 3 years ago to look for government misconduct during the probe of potential ties between Donald Trump's campaign and Russia. The trial focused on whether Sussman concealed from the FBI that he was working for Clinton's campaign when he presented data he said showed a possible secret back channel between a Russia-based bank and the Trump Organization. The FBI quickly determined there was no suspicious contact. The verdict is a setback for Durham, who remains at work during the Biden administration. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Spain's government wants to end one-sided, mind-numbing, computer-generated answering services by making it a law for companies to offer a real flesh-and-blood customer service worker when requested to do so by a caller. The measure is part of a package of new items included in a consumer service bill presented by Spain's ruling left-wing coalition government Tuesday. The bill will need the approval of Spain's parliament before it can become law. The bill would also seek to do away with long wait times by forcing companies to answer calls within 3 minutes. Providers of basic services such as utilities, phone, and internet will have to offer customer service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. All other companies will have to provide customer service during working hours. All customer service complaints will have to be responded to within 15 days. Repeating the hour's top news story, three more nations have joined an international investigation probing war crimes in Ukraine. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. And here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
For those who took Muni and kept her for this long, I pray you have a change of mindset. You are perpetrating pain and suffering on people.
That was Muma B. Yovonne of the Cameroon Women's Peace Movement on soldiers freeing Senator Regina Mundi a month after she was kidnapped by separatists. Details coming up. Also, the head of the Methodist Church of Nigeria has regained his freedom a day after unknown gunmen kidnapped him. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The head of the African Union is calling on Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to lower tensions. The DRC accuses Rwanda of supporting the rebel group M23, which continues to battle the Congolese army in eastern Congo. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, analysts are doubtful the tensions or the situation in eastern Congo will soon improve.
Calm has returned in some parts of the eastern DRC, which saw heavy fighting last week between the Congolese army and the rebel group M23. Jean Mobatsenga is Amnesty International's DRC researcher. He tells VOA there is a lull in the fighting.
So when it comes to M23, there is some calm now over the last few days. There have been no clashes reported. And in some parts, civilians who had fled have started to return. But that doesn't mean that the conflict is over. Civilians are still being killed by other armed groups. So it's not only the M23 which is the problem. There are also other groups who have been killing people and are continuing to kill civilians with impunity.
Reports say the Congolese army, with the help of the UN peacekeeping force MONUSCO, recently repelled a rebel advance on the city of Goma. The reports say M23 fighters have now returned to their hideouts near the border with Uganda. But residents of North Kivu and Ituri remain fearful of M23 and other armed groups in the region, which have competed for years for control of the area's rich mines. Some of the groups have ties to Rwanda, Uganda or Burundi. The DRC government accuses Rwanda of supporting M23 in an effort to destabilize the country. In a statement Monday, Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Biruta encouraged its neighbor to de-escalate its rhetoric. He said collaboration could restore security and bring lasting stability to the region. The minister also said the rebel group M23 was Congo's internal problem and should be resolved among Congolese themselves. On his Twitter account, African Union chairperson Senegalese President Macky Sall said he's concerned about the tension between the DRC and Rwanda. Sall said he spoke to DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame in a quest to find a peaceful resolution to the crisis. Researcher and political analyst Ntanyoma Rukumbuzi says the tension between the countries and the unrest in the DRC are likely to continue.
I don't see in the near future any escalation involving directly both countries, Rwanda and DRC. Because both countries have interest to dialogue and settle many of these issues in a pacific way, through the dialogue. But would this be enough if Rwanda and DRC agrees to solve their tension in a pacific way? Would this lead to the stability of the Eastern DRC? I'm not sure.
M23 insists it is fighting ethnic Hutu groups to protect the minority Tutsi living along the border between Congo and Rwanda. But Human Rights Watch DRC senior researcher Thomas Fessy notes M23 was expelled from peace talks between Congo and various armed groups that took place in Kenya at the end of April.
All of this has created a context of tension which is sparking fears of new military confrontation on Congolese territory. And civilians are always the ones to pay the biggest price. In a few days of heavy fighting near Goma, over 70,000 people were displaced, according to humanitarian organizations. Many of them will now need assistance.
Congo is home to some 5.6 million internally displaced people, more than any other country in Africa. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Tunisia's powerful UGTT trade union announced today plans for a public sector strike on June 16th to protest runaway inflation and reject any moves to privatize public firms. The announcement, according to the French news agency AFP, comes as Tunisians struggle with a grinding economic crisis and as President Kais Saied's government negotiates with the International Monetary Fund for a $4 billion bailout package in exchange for potentially painful economic reforms. The union accused Saied's government of undermining the principle of negotiation and backtracking on previously agreed deals at a time when the North African country is experiencing insane and ongoing price rises. Last week, the union said it would not take part in a national dialogue proposed by Saied, arguing that it excludes key political actors and civil society groups. Saied sacked the entire government last July before dissolving parliament and moving to rule by decree, in moves opponents call a coup d'etat against the only democracy to emerge from the Arab spring uprisings. Cameroon's military says it has freed a senator who was held captive by separatists for a month along with other hostages. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's military on Tuesday said it managed to rescue Senator Regina Munti after what a spokesman called 2 days of heavy battles with rebels who had taken her hostage. Military spokesman Serge Cyril Atonfak said in a press release that the clashes took place in Batibo district in Cameroon's northwest region. Atonfak said separatists tried to escape advancing government troops on Sunday with 6 hostages, including Senator Mondi. But he said the troops stopped the rebels, killing 10 of them and capturing 3 without any harm to the captives. The military did not identify the other hostages, but said they were receiving medical treatment after the ordeal. Rights groups in Cameroon welcomed Senator Mundi's release after a month in captivity. Muma B. Yvonne of the Women's Peace Movement led church prayers for Mundi's release after her April abduction.
I hope she's sound health-wise. For those who took Mundi and kept her for this long, I pray you have a change of mindset. You are perpetrating pain and suffering on people. I congratulate those who succeeded in getting her and others out.
A separatist spokesman confirmed that government troops freed Mundi and other hostages, but denied the military's claim that fighters were killed and captured. Capo Daniel is deputy defense chief of the Ambazona Defense Forces, one of Cameroon's rebel groups. The separatists have been fighting since 2017 to break away from Cameroon and its French-speaking majority to create an English-speaking state called Ambazonia. Daniel says the military abused civilians during the weekend raids to free Senator Mundi.
Hundreds of Cameroon military brutalized our civilian population, rounded them up, tied their hands behind their backs. Women were tortured, houses were searched, occupants were tied up. and forced to sit in city squares where they were not allowed to have access to communication. None of our soldiers were killed or captured. We have regrouped, and we will make sure that those areas remain under strong Ambazonian control.
None of Daniel's claims could be immediately or independently confirmed. One local who did not want to be identified for fear of retaliation told VOA both sides committed abuses and detained civilians during the clashes. Cameroon's military denies any abuses. Armed separatists abducted Senator Mundi with her driver in Bamenda, capital of the English-speaking Northwest region, on April 30. The rebels accused Mundi of collaborating with Cameroon's central government and demanded 47 of the arrested leaders be freed in return for her release. The government refused. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
As preparations for the 2023 general elections in Nigeria intensify, political parties are expected to conclude their primaries ahead of the June 9th extension by Nigeria's electoral umpire, the Independent National Electoral Commission. There are concerns that allegations of massive vote buying in determining the candidates may undermine the emergence of competent and credible leaders for Nigeria. We have more from Abuja, Nigeria.
In recent days, reports have emerged of political party delegates accepting bribes by aspirants, asking to be named as official candidates for political office. Several videos and images have emerged showing contestants openly offering cash and valuables to party delegates who select those who will contest on the local, state and national levels. Anwar Musa Rafsanjani is the chairman of the Independent Election Monitoring Organization that monitors and observes the vote, the Transition Monitoring Group. He laments the commercialization of the selection of candidates in the party primaries.
The Transition Monitoring Group is deeply worried and concerned with the way politicians have turned the electoral process into a commercial or a business venture. Vote buying is happening at parties' primaries, which is also undermining the emergence of capable, competent, qualified, experienced, non-corruptible Nigerians at all levels.
Rafsanjani says unless it's immediately addressed, the trend endangers democracy in Nigeria.
In Kaduna, it has happened. In many of the part of the country, it has happened. And there were so many videos that had been in circulation where people were actually giving out money for votes buying. So there has been a well-established, evidence. And that's why we were surprised that up to now, the anti-corruption agencies have not been able to arrest the perpetrators of this crime, which is against our electoral law.
Since the return of democracy to Nigeria in May 1999, vote buying has steadily grown in scale and brazenness. Civil society groups and many concerned Nigerians say financial inducements to delegates are tantamount to mortgaging the country's future. Jidojo is a public affairs analyst and political scientist. He says there's a provision in Nigeria's Electoral Act concerning vote buying.
If you open to Section 121 and 127 of the Electoral Act 2022, it actually criminalizes vote buying. There are even other sections of the law that criminalizes buying of permanent voter's card, that's voter's card, and other campaign finance infractions.
Nigerian parties do not allow all of its members to directly vote for a candidate, which is common in open primaries. Instead, the country's parties name influential delegates who then choose candidates from a number of competing aspirants. And some of those office seekers offer money to sway the delegates. Ojo emphasizes that this indirect system is prone to corruption due to the small number of people involved in choosing the official nominee.
If they are chosen direct primary, in which case all registered members of the parties are involved in the choice of the candidate of the party, it will have been very difficult to compromise or induce that huge number of party members.
Ojo blamed the Nigerian parliament and President Muhammadu Buhari for failing to agree on reforms to the Electoral Act that would make the process more transparent and discourage bribery. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
Police say the head of the Methodist Church of Nigeria, His Eminence Samuel Kanu Uche, and two other senior clerics regained their freedom a day after unknown gunmen kidnapped them in the country's southeast. Police told the Associated Press that the three men were snatched along the highway in the Omonochi area in southeastern Abia State. Abductions for ransom have become a worrying trend in Africa's most populous nation. Though the abductions are more rampant in troubled northwestern Nigeria, the southeast has also grappled with violent attacks in recent years. Authorities have blamed the indigenous people of Biafra, a leading separatist group, for many of the attacks. The leadership of the Christian Association of Nigeria has condemned the kidnappings and urged President Muhammadu Buhari to stop them. Libya's ambassador to the UN, Tahir al-Sunni, told the Security Council that it has failed to implement decisions or impose punishments on either individuals or states that hamper a political solution. He highlighted the division of the Security Council on many issues, saying Libyans were left uncertain on who's to blame for the UN's failure in Libya, the strategy, or the UN envoys sent there. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
So I think this highlights a long-standing issue with the UN and the UN Security Council on Libya, that they really are very divided on Libya and have been unable to issue any decisions, to make any sanctions, to really have any direct impact on what's happening in Libya. We saw the meeting Tahir al-Sunni was speaking about, and there were lots of different statements about Libya, but no decisions were made. There were different focuses by different actors. Some are focused on elections. Others, like Russia, want to see a new UN envoy appointed as the primary thing to happen. There's a lot of division over that. And I think Libyans have really lost trust in the UN as an institution because it hasn't been able to help solve the problem, and they haven't been able to solve their own political divisions. And it's made the situation much more complicated. And at the moment, we don't have a UN envoy, and there's unlikely to be one anytime soon because it is difficult to reach agreement. And it means there's a lack of leadership from the UN. And what we tend to have is a lot of meetings and statements and focus on holding elections, but very little in the way of tangible action. And unfortunately, that's unlikely to change anytime soon.
Libya's ambassador to the United Nations met with the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Greenfield, to review the current situation and challenges facing political process in Libya. He said the importance of America's role in supporting peaceful solution to the crisis was emphasized in the meeting to avoid any military escalation or armed confrontations. What could the U.S. do to support a political process in Libya and avert some sort of armed conflict?
So the US at the moment, we are seeing, is quite heavily engaged in Libya. However, they're not really focusing on the kind of military or armed conflict aspect, and I don't think we'll see that anytime soon. However, the main focus for the US is, first of all, to push for elections, but they're primarily letting the UN lead on elections, although, as we just discussed, the UN isn't leading really on elections, so it's unlikely we're going to see elections anytime soon in Libya. But what the US is doing, and it is able to bring some pressure to bear on this, is trying to really depoliticize the Libyan economy. So it's trying to prevent Libya's vast oil wealth, which is a key driver of a lot of the conflict and a lot of the actions by armed groups. And it's trying to protect that in the National Oil Corporation, in the Central Bank of Libya, by introducing some financial mechanisms to protect it. Now, so far, it hasn't really made any tangible progress, but it is working closely with a lot of the actors involved. And that is what it's hoping can make a difference, that if it can isolate those funds and prevent them from being accessed by some of the armed groups and political actors, that that will help return stability and make it less of a driver for armed conflict in the future.
So what kind of a compromise Stephanie Williams could use in next month's meeting of Libyan rivals in Cairo to reach some sort of a consensus?
Unfortunately, although the meeting between the HRI and the HSC, which is the main aim, is to try and find a constitutional basis for elections, although they've made, in theory, some progress, they've agreed on certain elements, they really haven't made any progress on the really contentious and thorny issues where there are lots of differences of opinion. And unfortunately, as discussed, because the UN is in a very weak position, because the internationals are very divided over the best approach to kind of solving the Libya conflict, I don't think, unfortunately, Stephanie Williams has much that she can use to force these actors to compromise. They still want to show the international community that they are willing. So I think we'll probably see some kind of symbolic gesture or agreement or process, but I think it's very unlikely that we'll see any kind of real momentum towards elections. And until the UN and the international actors on Libya are aligned and can agree on a way forward and a political process or an approach that they can implement, then I think Libyan actors know full well that they're not really going to have any sanctions or any kind of real pressure from the internationals, because they're all pulling in different directions.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Two days after Sudanese military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan lifted the state of emergency on Sudan and released political detainees, street protests have continued. Anti-coup activists are still demanding a civilian-run government, as they have since the October 2021 military coup. What is the way forward? Are most civilians and the international community open to negotiations? Sudanese political analyst Jihad Mashmoun tells VOA's Carol Van Dam there have been signs of compromise from all sides.
That does seem encouraging in creating an environment for dialogue between both sides, the military and the civilian opposition. In the same instance, I'm inclined to say that it's too early to determine the intention of the military component and how the civilian opposition will interact with it.
Does it open the door to negotiations with the international community about the way forward? Or is it impossible to envision, you know, a military-run government being sustainable for any lengthy period of time, the way things are?
Now, the international community has always been focusing since the military coup of October, 25th of October, 2021. The international community has always been focusing on a civil-military partnership. Every time you say, we would like a civilian-led democracy, that means that the military is going to be involved in it. Now, here I have to emphasize that the civilian, people in the streets, especially the resistance committee, they've been against any partnership with the military. So what happened, in essence, within this long protest that happened, is that the UN and the African Union, you got formed a triatular between three different organizations to lead the dialogue process. There are currently indirect negotiations between the civilians and the opposition. At the same instance, the people are still protesting at the streets and they're being led by the resistance committee. These are the real mobilizers of the street at the moment. The international community, if it really wants to help Sudan, it can actually help Sudan by imposing a warning to the military to improve the situation further. And by warning, I mean specifically mention targeted sanctions against the military component or those who are obstructing the dialogue process. Both sides have to compromise, the military and the civilian opposition.
Right. And when you talk about that, how do you envision that compromise being played out?
The civilians need to understand that this dialogue is a way of trying to understand what the military wants to achieve. Does it want to stay in power? Is Lieutenant General Burhan and Hameti, they're avoiding the inquiry to what happened to the ending of the protest side of 2019? Or are they protecting the former regime or certain groups within the former regime? That's what the civilians need to focus on. And the military on their side, they can improve the environment that's happening in Sudan, such as allowing the people to continue the protests, provided, of course, the process ensure that the security of the civil people protesting. And by ensuring security, I mean that ensuring that no one is harmed.
That was researcher and political analyst Jihad Mashmoun, who is also a researcher fellow at the Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies in Exeter, England. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam, on Tuesday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.